Good afternoon. I'm Hunt Tooley, and this is a course on the totalitarians. This is the third class meeting, and I would like to welcome everyone to it. We are in the midst of a course that's part of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, the Mises Academy, and the course is the totalitarians. I am Hunt Tooley. And it's an 8-week course, and so let's take a look at where we are in the course. This is our 8 weeks plan. Always the plan from the totalitarian end, and our totalitarian plan is that we did some introductory history on the first week of the course. Went way back to Aristotle and Plato, and even back farther, and brought things up to the more or less the 19th century. Then we slowed down in the second part of the second lecture, and really concentrated on the book by Ludwig von Mises, Omniptic Government, which forms the center part of this course, both theoretically and historically. And so we took the first two big sections of that book and tried to make something of that. We had a lively question and answer about that, and we especially focused in on the concepts nationalism and Mises' word etatism, by which he meant a particular kind of statism, which he describes in this economic and cultural way, and which actually is in a sense a kind of neo-mercantilism. But in any case, we dealt with that sort of immediate theoretical and historical background. And so today, we go to the third section of Omnipotent Government, and we take actually the German case in particular. And we'll spend our next, the good little while, the most part of the lecture, talking about what Mises says about the German background. In addition to talking about what he says, talking about the background itself, I would like for many of these events that Mises sort of assumes we know to become clear to you and to come alive to you. And so I'm really working toward that in my presentation today, and I hope that works. And if it doesn't work in the lecture, then it's bound to work in the question and answer, because you can ask questions, and we'll get that all cleared up. So we move from this to talking specifically about World War I next week, and then we're all along the way, we've mentioned Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, and others, but we will begin to zero in more on their lives and their roles, especially in the early parts of establishing totalitarianism next week. Then we move on to the more radical, you might say more higher body count phases of these total regimes in the week after that. And then we'll spend a whole week comparing total regimes and then work on some conclusions, and also try to get a broader sense of who the rest of the totalitarians are besides our accepted ones. So that's where we are in the 8 weeks plan, and it's absorbing material, it's interesting material, it's necessary material for those of us who are interested in liberty to understand the exact opposite and the relationship of totalitarianism, not only to liberty but to statism and many of the other doctrines that we talk about often. So, without further ado, let's just plunge in. And I would like to talk first about German unification. This is in the background for Ludwig von Mises, and I talked a little bit about the German background, the deeper German background last time, but I want on the first lecture, I mean. But this time, I would like to take this kind of step-by-step, Stufenweise, the Germans say, and move through this just to get the sort of broad outline of German unification in your mind. It may be you studied this already in a college course, or that you've done a lot of reading on it, that you're interested in Bismarck and you know all this, but let me just go through these major points, and that way we'll all be on the same page. We really zeroed in on Mises' comments about Bismarck and the constitutional struggle and the German liberals last week. Let me back up now and just explain this framework. The Prussian king, well, Prussia is one of the many states of the what was formerly the Holy Roman Empire. That was wiped out by Napoleon early in the century. And Napoleon reformed Germany into a number of different alliances and bundles and whatnot. And Germany became, in effect, a part of the Napoleonic Empire up until 1814, when Napoleon lost for the first time. And so what was established at the Congress of Vienna in 1815 was a Germanic confederation. That is to say, a league of German states. Austria was the permanent head of it. Prussia was jealous because Austria was the head. And so from 1815 until 1867, really, this Germanic confederation was the framework for the German state system. Well, that's the one we talked about through the Revolution of 1848, which had a very kind of electrifying result on the German state system. It made the Germans think more about building a single state. It meant to liberals that where they had thought of making a liberal Germany, they had first to make a Germany, they thought, and then worry about liberalism. You can compare this with the view of Thomas Jefferson, who didn't much care if there was one United States, one country, as long as there was Republican liberty in one or more or however many states. And so it's a similar case. These liberals took the different path. They eventually said, well, you've got to have the power to make a country first before you can make a liberal country. And this is precisely the point where Mises, as we looked at last week, saw their mistake, that they caved in on the principle part and accepted the power part. So that's the issue in 1848, the 1850s, 1860s. The old Prussian king, a real reactionary, Frederick William IV, first became insane and then died. And his successor, William, faced a constitutional crisis and really brought Bismarck, a diplomat who had worked in the diplomatic corps for several years, brought Bismarck in as prime minister to solve the problem. Bismarck was known as a real reactionary East Elbian Junker nobleman, and Bismarck actually just ran roughshod over the Prussian parliament, which had a lot of liberals in it, and they didn't like it. But when he succeeded, then they ratified that post facto. That took place, as we said last time, in a series of wars. So Bismarck was able to construct a unified Germany out of three different wars. As important as Bismarck was in this way, it's pretty clear that he was not himself an enormous nationalist. He certainly was a statist, but his state in particular was Prussia. And what historians, I think, generally would agree upon now, not all but most, was that Bismarck had in mind the saving of Prussia, the saving of this older dynasty, the saving of the Hohenzollern family that ruled it into modern times, and that could be done by unifying Germany and building a big, booming industrial state of the kind that he thought was so successful, and to make it a nation state. So So Bismarck used nationalism as he used industry, as he used social policy and everything else in the service of Prussia. Well, there was a war in which Austria and Prussia fought Denmark. That's hard to believe these days, but it's true. They won, not immediately, but there was a big war that took place in 1864. And because of the frictions coming from this war, especially having to do with the northern territories, Schleswig and Holstein, then Bismarck was able to, you might say, provoke another war, this one with Austria, against Austria. So it's the Austro-Prussian War, 1866. In this war, Bismarck's reformed military and William's reformed military that Mises speaks of so much in Omnipotent Government was hugely successful, defeated the Austrians in very short order, and therefore set up a North German Confederation, that is the Germanic Confederation, basically without Austria and some of the southern German states. In this Austro-Prussian War, he not only defeated but excluded Austria from the German entity that he was building. The next war that he provoked was a war with France, and we won't go into the details, although they're highly interesting. How the nephew of the great Napoleon, the Emperor Napoleon III, was in a sense bamboozled into attacking Prussia, and how then the other German states rallied round, and Prussia, in the course of winning this Franco-Prussian War, 1870-71, how Prussia then became the leader in a movement to unify Germany, not as a parliamentary being, but rather as an aristocratic federal being in which each of the princes gave allegiance to the Prussian king, who would also now have the title German Emperor or Kaiser. So that's the way that Germany became unified, and the war was still going on. The siege of Paris was still in progress, and the announcement of all this was made in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, the great palace of the absolutist Louis XIV. So it's almost, to the French, a direct insult that Germany arose out of this victorious war, while the French were so far down that the great commune, a communist uprising, broke out in Paris in 1871. The government itself escaped by balloon and went elsewhere. France was at pretty much a low point and eventually surrendered, and a treaty was negotiated, the Treaty of Frankfurt, in May 1871. And France lost a lot. The Germans really put it to them. But Bismarck was not especially happy with how much the Prussians eventually took from France. For one thing, they took a big chunk of territory, and Bismarck understood that these territorial acquisitions always form a kind of burr under the saddle for later relations. No matter what happens, there's always that territory to stand there in the way. And so when Alsace-Lorraine came to the new united Germany, then Bismarck, I think, knew that this would be a perpetual thorn in France's side. France was also stuck with a huge indemnity and other punishments. So the Frankfurt Treaty was fairly punitive. Not nearly as punitive as the Versailles Treaty would be later on, but still punitive, no doubt about that. So the Germans were now the Germans. They had a country, and it was a country that was really formed in Bismarck's image. He literally wrote the Constitution himself. He didn't respond. We're going to talk about a later German constitution here in just a little while, and unlike as was the case with that one, Bismarck did not at all refer this to committees or anything else. He just wrote the constitution, had some people look over it and say, well, here's how we need to cross the I's and dot the T's, and that was the Constitution. Interestingly, where Prussia had a very limited suffrage, as Mises described it in the book, where richer people had votes that were more valuable and poorer people had votes that were less, and those in the middle had the middling level of power in their votes. In the case of the German Empire, Bismarck was betting that all the peasants and farmers and working people would be conservative and that they would vote conservative. That was his express intention in setting up universal manhood suffrage. So now Prussia exists. Bismarck is still the Prime Minister of Prussia, but he's also the Chancellor of Germany. Germany is a federally constructed, combined Germany that includes the big South German states and big states like Saxony, and then tiny little states as federal states, and then Prussia, which is actually 3/5 of the whole thing. So there's this hegemony in the structure of the new Germany that is that means it's there's a lot of Prussian in there. And so the ruling class of Prussia Germany, as you might call it, was partly in the Prussian government and administration and partly in the Reich or federal government or administration. And this hegemonial standing of Prussia within the German Empire was something that people discussed all the time and understood. So universal suffrage at large, but in Prussia, a limited suffrage. The other states had their own version of suffrage. It was, in fact, a country that was étatist, whereas Prussia had, as we studied last week, and this, of course, is really important, Prussia had economic freedom in its past, a good bit more than one would think. In the 19th century, as we said, there was a really healthy dose of freedom. I would say that on the continent of Europe, no country had a less statist atmosphere in the economy than Prussia did in the 1820s and 30s, 40s. However, these things began to change in the 50s as nationalism came to the fore. And by the time we get Bismarck, not only is there a nationalist element to the étatism of Germany, but Bismarck's also into the game of playing to the masses. So there's that universal suffrage, right? And then there's also Bismarck's essential, it's not quite true that he invented social security systems or medical systems, or that he invented welfare. It's really not the case, but it certainly is the fact that Germany's system was among the very first to have widespread mandated medical insurance and some unemployment insurance and so forth. So Bismarck thought in this way, well, I know the lower orders will always vote conservative, but I'll gain their allegiance by giving them bread and circuses and unemployment insurance and that type of thing. So this is really the case. In other areas too, Bismarck was very much a neo-mercantilist, and he used that without any regard for economic freedom. In the cases where there remained economic freedom in Germany, just because Bismarck didn't really, and the government didn't really deem it useful. He was a pragmatist in all ways, a Realpolitiker, as the Germans say, the politics of reality, a real pragmatic kind of politician and statesman. And so sometimes there was a bit of freedom here or there, but it's only because that seemed to be useful. So Germany, for example, under Bismarck, especially after the 1873 Depression set in, carried out a wide-ranging scheme of very high and very goal-oriented tariffs to favor Russian wheat for a time when an alliance was needed, and to disfavor it at other times, and you get the picture here. So it's a wide-ranging use of economic policy and trade policy, and to further these ETATist goals. So it certainly is an ETATist political system. The Depression did hit in 1873. It's the usual story. I don't think most people in an audience of those who signed up to talk about omnipotent government, Mises' book, will be very mystified by the fact that the economies of the winners and losers were inflated in wartime. There was all kinds of fiscal expansion during those times to carry out the wars. The French had a huge indemnity they had to pay, and they inflated their currency to help pay it, which in turn expanded the German currency supply. And so there's all kinds of what the years called the founder years of the German Empire, 1871, 72, early 73. Then business expanded at a huge rate. Almost all of it, of course, malinvestment based on the distortions of the market because of the expanded currency. So. No surprise, the bubble burst in 1873, the Great Depression. To Europeans, for many years, this was the Great Depression. That began in 1873, and it continued really all the way into the 90s in some form or fashion, as these depressions do, because of the usual, for the usual reasons. We know all this depression stuff only too well these days, don't we? I mean, we know it firsthand, and so... in a way, you can talk about it in shorthand because these ETATist governments, whether they're in the 19th century, the 20th century, or the 18th century, they tend to react in the same way. They sometimes have some different tools, but they tend to react in the same way. So we can almost speak of these things in a shorthand as long as we understand the principles. Interesting politics in the German Empire. And before I say this, I mean, I have no slot here to say this. This was a culture that was, in many ways, a dynamic culture devoted to arts and science and industrial applications of science, and all the state schools had been states. All the schools have been state schools and part of the state, even since Martin Luther's time in the 1500s. And so the schools supported the art scene and the industry and orchestra development and all of that. So in terms of being an ETATist regime, it was a highly successful one in many ways, at least for in the short term. That is to say, it put a lot of money in places that impressed a lot of people. So that when Americans thought of going for a PhD someplace in the world in the 1880s, they thought of going to Germany, and you could cite many examples of that. Well, the Germany they were going to was a Germany that was, for all its apparent successes, it was fraught with trouble. For example, Bismarck almost immediately, I mean, the war was hardly over, the Constitution inked hardly dry, when Bismarck declared war on a new party that was a Catholic party called the Center Party. In German, das Zentrum, the Center Party. And this war against the Center Party came about because Bismarck, and you see the little picture there between Berlin and Rome, Bismarck took the tendencies in Rome to, including the actual Declaration of Papal Infallibility, to heart. By means of unification, Germany now had a country that was about to a fifth and even more third Catholic, Bismarck was quite concerned about political Catholicism, and he said, well, if the Pope is infallible and the Pope tells people to vote against me, then what? If the Pope tells people to vote against the state, then what? And so Bismarck declared war, as he called it, a culture war. Now, this, so you see today when people talk about the culture war, this is not the first culture war either. Bismarck declared one in 1871, and for 7 years, he carried out a pretty stiff war against the Catholic Party, which had just been founded a few years before, was run by several outstanding German politicians, especially South German politicians, Ludwig Windthorst and a number of others. And the party was not quite outlawed, but it was harassed, it was put under surveillance, it had its newspaper offices closed, it had its public events shut down. And so where Bismarck could carry out the war against the Catholics, the war for culture, for the war for civilization, he said, then he did so. The net result of this was that it made for a leaner, meaner, better center party, a Catholic party, and the party came out of it very, very strong, and in a very important piece of the German parliamentary system. At about the time that Bismarck ended that, and partly related to it, Bismarck also declared war on the Social Democratic Party. The Socialist Party, which we'll talk about quite a bit today, was founded in Germany in the 60s and in Prussia, and had become a part of the International Workmen's Association. It was a Marxist party. Also had a lot of labor union influence in it, and so labor leaders and Marxist revolutionaries and so forth mixed up into this Social Democratic Party of Germany, the SPD. And Bismarck realized that he had miscalculated. By the late 70s, it began to occur to him that there were so many people moving to cities, that German industry had drawn so many people to urban environments, that the socialist appeal would have much more fodder. And so he tried to stamp out the Socialist Party in the same way he had tried to stamp out the center party, the Catholic Party, and actually with the same results, although the repression was even worse. What he actually did was to make German socialism in many ways, especially in cultural ways, by driving them into a kind of ghettoized existence where they were socialists, were persecuted, but they developed their own life, their own clubs, their own meetings, their own soccer leagues, their own culture within German society. So it became a culture within a culture, and that sense of togetherness and commonality and comradeship really fostered the Socialist Party more than any of the ideals of Marx or anybody else. So so once again, we have this kind of situation emerging in which Bismarck attacks and strengthens the enemy. I want to mention, as long as we're in this place, that Bismarck, as I think probably everybody knows, created a humdinger of an alliance system. And it was all based on isolating France because he had just beaten France and humiliated France, and he knew that the French would hate Germany pretty much from then on in his mind. And so he tried to make alliances that would isolate France. And I've got to say this, in the alliance system game, you frequently hear this period, this Bismarckian period, blamed for the later war. But actually, this period was quite successful. I mean, he successfully kept France from having any really strong partners. He successfully kept Germany in safe alliances. And so even though he had created the country using three different wars, after this he declared that he was a big peacemaker. And he did, in fact, keep the peace in that way. So the alliance system, as long as it had this really smart impresario presiding over it, that alliance system was in Europe was pretty safe. There were, however, problems. One problem was that Bismarck finally acceded to demands from the press and from the professors and from the socialists of the chair and from newspaper people and from missionaries, from all kinds of people, to start a colonial empire. And Germany, he did hold off. He would not allow Germany to go into a kind of colonial situation the way France and especially England, Britain, and other countries had done, and Italy too. But instead, he held out against that until the 1880s when he was finally persuaded. And just before Bismarck left his post and had his resignation accepted, Germany launched into a colonial empire that ended up giving them huge territories, not only in the Pacific and some and in Asia, but especially in Africa, in East Africa, West Africa, and German Southwest Africa, of course, Cameroon in the west, Tanganyika in German East Africa, and so forth and so on. So Germany set up a big colonial empire. That's going to become important to us later on. So Bismarck resists at first and then accedes to that. In the end, Bismarck thought he had to unmake his own constitution. He was of the opinion that he had made it and he could unmake it. He would just have to write a more conservative, more harsh, more autocratic constitution than the one he had written before because his attack on the socialists had failed and he had so many opponents and all that. Oddly, William II, the grandson of his co-founder, William I, was a person who is going to go down in history known as an arch-conservative, aristocratic bad guy because he's Kaiser Bill of the First World War. But this young man, when he came to power at age 32, really didn't like Bismarck's attempts to carry out a coup against the Constitution, as Bismarck kept saying. And so they clashed over this, and Bismarck repeatedly would hand his resignation to William II in a kind of huff, knowing that the young king couldn't accept the resignation of so influential a person. And finally, in 1890, William II accepted it. And so Bismarck left power, and the old pilot left the ship, as people said, his successors came about. Now, the problem was that his successors were, one problem was they were not as skillful, and the other problem was that they were still statists, they were still étatists. And in many ways, the whole atmosphere became, if anything, worse for the, we're still keeping all this in perspective as a kind of deep background to totalitarianism. Then there's still this, there's a lot to come here before we get to the Nazis. And now we go deeply into that, that immediate sort of pre-Nazi history. And that's very, very important for us, very crucial. So let me say something about these successors to Bismarck. The chancellors, I could name them for you. You could look them up on Wikipedia, too. You probably won't remember their names, and one reason is that they're not people of distinction and people of note. I mean, they're not giant; they're hardly giants. And so, one reason. I mean, as we get to World War I, the sort of standard song and dance about the alliance system breaking down, all that. I mean, the Germans just didn't run it very well. They made those people mad whom they shouldn't have made mad, and they flattered and became close to the people they shouldn't have been close to, just in terms of German policy itself. So, yeah, that's a part of the story there. More importantly, I think, more important for us is a series of kind of tendencies that come to the fore in the late 19th century in Germany after Bismarck leaves. So from 1890 until 1914. Social Darwinism. It's extremely important for us here in a multiplicity of ways. It's not so much, and Mises covers this in the book. It was in the reading last week. It's not so much an issue here of Darwin himself, but rather Darwin's interpreters who take the scientific data within the Origin of the Species and say, well, this is applicable to society, and it doesn't take any millions of years to see it because you can see this now. If you carry out this policy, if you don't strengthen the hygiene of the race, then the race goes down. So there's an intense discussion of social Darwinism, and we talked about this a little bit last week in connection with positivism too. In all countries, there were certainly German positivists, and many of those positives were social Darwinists. In Germany, there were technical social Darwinists like the scientific illustrator who's famous for having made all the pictures of the embryos and shown the sort of chain of existence. There were folks who took Darwin and the idea of the survival of the fittest and said, well, in our society, we have to be careful subsidizing with all these social insurance schemes the people who are unfit because that means they'll survive and we don't necessarily in the long run want them to survive. There's especially a social Darwinism that backs up imperialism so that, and this works in a couple of different ways. First of all, there's the helpful social Darwinism where we're going to go out and help people become more civilized and more advanced and more evolved, okay? And then there's a secondary argument there that says, well, we're going to go out and help people because they're less evolved, and therefore we owe it to them as the more evolved Northern Europeans to go out and help the less evolved. And then there's another level of this argument. All these made in different proportions by different, sometimes the same people, but usually by different people in different groups. There's the other argument that is, these people are inferior, and if we need to go kill them then, to get the land, then, you know, we're just doing everybody a favor. So, not in such bald terms, but almost. Therefore, social Darwinism is pretty important. And then there's another aspect. I want to save that until I get down to the imperialism and the Navy League part just below. Going along with the social Darwinism, and this I think is quite fascinating. It's been the study of a number of great American historians of Germany in the last 40 and 50 years, and that is the idea that there was a kind of cultural pessimism that went along with social Darwinism in considerable measure. Social Darwinism everywhere, but especially in the German case of social Darwinism. If you look to, for example, the man who was commander-in-chief of the German armies on the eve of World War I, the nephew of that great Moltke, M-O-L-T-K-E, this guy was a very educated guy, a very committed sort of social Darwinist and so forth, and he was also a cultural pessimist. He thought that the message of social Darwinism was that we're kind of going nowhere, but we have to stick with it. We have to help our race, and there will be this big battle, but who knows who will win? That there's a kind of Armageddon ahead, but you know, who knows? Same way, there's a famous diary of Kurt Rietzler, R-I-E-Z-L-E-R, who was an assistant to the German Prime Minister just before and the first part of World War I, Beth von Hollweg. And Rietzler wrote this long and wonderful diary in which he just explains the world in terms of huge, big movements, clashing armies, clashing strategies, It's kind of a world of Darwinian entities all battling against each other and fighting for the outcome. And he's just not sure that the Germans are best and that the Germans will be, you know, you say may the best man win. He's not sure they're the best man. And so there's that kind of cultural pessimism that overtakes many individuals, sometimes also connected with the tendencies of spiritualism, oddly enough. These doctrines of theosophy, Mises mentions these in Omnipotent Government, that, and many of these doctrines were strangely mixed in here. And that's also a constant in German social Darwinism, and we're going to see this a lot in Hitler and a lot in parallel totalitarian type movements and social Darwinist movements in modern Germany. There's a lot of this. There's a lot of a kind of mystical side to that as well. Nationalism, I think we talked about. I mean, with Germany unified, everybody was proud of their big country. And imperialism was used as a way to express that. And here it's very important. There's a number of ways that people utilized and justified and thought about imperialism in Germany. And one of the important ones was, two of the important ones were different sides of social imperialism. First, the one that Mises does not discuss as much in the book, the one to do with the socialists themselves. There's an argument within leading circles in Germany that Germany should become an imperial country because of this. We're losing the workers. They're going over to the socialists in droves. And what we need is a big navy. What we need is German influence across the world. We need to spread German colonies of people because we don't have that much space to expand. We need to spread these colonies, but still keep them all connected with a big naval, big maritime empire all in Africa and the South Pacific, etc. And we need to do that. And one reason we need to do that is because we can link in these workers to the empire through the Navy. Because if you think about it, what kind of people are in the Navy? I mean, we know what kind of people have traditionally been in the Army. It's always been peasant boys, right? I mean, in European history, the armies are always, at least 90% peasant boys. But these imperialists argue, now what we see is that in modern navies, with these ships that frankly just look like a big floating factory, these appeal as always to city kids. It's city boys who run away and join the Navy or who sign up to be in the Navy. And so navies, if we have big navies that link together this big empire, then we can tie these people to us. They'll become part of the system. They'll see the German flag flying over Togoland the Bismarck Archipelago and say, that is Germany, I'm proud of that. So that's a kind of social imperialism. You know, the interesting thing is that the socialists of the chair, Otto Wagner and that whole crowd, expressed, as we saw today in the reading, expressed a very similar kind of social imperialist philosophy that went along with a Kantism, that went along with partial socialism, really interventionism in the economy, a kind of planned economy, a kind of humanistic religion that sort of is based on we'll have a big community and link all ourselves together and do good for others and do good for all these lesser human beings and all of that. So these things are very much connected. A lot of this was promoted, a lot of this type of thinking was promoted by the Pan-German League. That's the Pan-Germanism that Mises talks about so much. The League itself was founded in 1891, though the movement had been going for some time. Pan-Germanism was about, it was the German name is the Alldeutsche Verband, the Pan-German League, and the aim of it is to get all Germans linked together across boundaries into one big kind of empire. In a way, it's ultra-nationalism. In a way, it's a kind of a new version of nationalism. It's planting colonies. It's like nationalism gone imperialistic, even more than it usually would. It's planting colonies elsewhere. Associated is the empire, and an offshoot of all this was the Navy League, which came into existence about the same time. That Navy League pushed and pushed and pushed for the building of a battle fleet. Germany didn't have really a high seas battle fleet, just a coastal defense, and this was tremendously expensive, involved a whole restructuring of the tax system, the introduction of income tax and all kinds of things, and this Navy League pushed for this, and the first naval law was passed in 1897, the second one in 1899. And so Germany invented a big navy, which coincidentally, put Germany in direct opposition to the British Navy. So that made this big imperial clash very important step here. These Pan-Germans promoted such ideas as the Schlieffen Plan, which was a war plan, a very highly aggressive war plan to attack France should France and Russia go to war with Germany. I won't say much about that. We could talk about it later if you like. In general, they're kind of preparing for Armageddon. War becomes a kind of tool of policy, empire certainly a tool of policy, and these Pan-Germans were very much in the vigorous sort of Teddy Roosevelt mode. Except they didn't really want to walk softly. They just they didn't mind walking hardly and carrying a big stick. So, where does anti-Semitism come into all this? There's this long and fascinating section on anti-Semitism in the book, and I want to deal with that in some considerable detail in the question and answer. It's very much the case, as some of you have already indicated in your writing about the atheism and nationalism, that that economic issues take the foreground here in many ways, that cultural issues are in there as well. And so let me just leave this to some good questions, and that way I'll get a sense of where you are in parsing this section of the book out, and we'll do that in the question and answer. So by the end of the century, by the time of World War I, Germany was a kind of atheist paradise. It was big industry created by corporate welfare, the modern corporation with all of the problematic aspects of it, that is to say the fact that it is a welfare system. It's just that the taxpayers support these big entities by guaranteeing liability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's corporate welfare. Germany became an outspoken advocate of cartelization, so that cartels were established and also registered officially with the government and government approved throughout the economy, so that there are informal cartels and formal cartels, and this development is just going to continue on. All of this was promoted by the socialists of the chair, and the empire really gave it the impetus there in the background. Now, our next week is devoted to World War I, and so I'm going to keep part of that, most of that back. The only thing I'd like to say now is this, that World War I was, in a sense, an accelerator of all this. If we say, as people who are interested in liberty, if we say that World War I is the thing that invented from this big witch's cauldron came out all these awful things like, taxes and currency manipulation, empire, all these things. Well, all you have to do is look at history and say, oh, that's not right. I mean, take the American income tax, for example. Take the Federal Reserve, for example. Take, all these cartels in Germany, for example. In other words, there's all kinds of things that you can say that disprove it. So World War One, serves as a kind of Higgsian, the ultimate Higgsian experience, because it takes all these tendencies, these statist tendencies, and accelerates them so fast that we really, it takes only 4 or 5 years, and then we have a sea change in the ways that modern Western societies are constructed and built. And so this sea change produces much increased, much intensified interventionist regimes. And it also produces much more intensified, hugely more powerful totalitarian regimes. And you might say, if we didn't know of all these precursors and forerunners and all that, we might say, well, it really did invent totalitarianism. You could come closer to making an argument for that, but I think we've seen a lot of these elements were in the mix already. They just hadn't come together before World War One. And so in the case of totalitarianism, it both put those together and accelerated. Okay, well, cut to the chase for Germany. They lost the war in the field. They were not stabbed in the back. There's a legend that they were stabbed in the back by Jews and liberals and all of that. And it's just, for anybody who's read the primary documents, and you can read them in printed form, I've read them in German archives, it's quite clear the Germans lost in the field. I mean, how can you fight the whole world for 4 years and not lose it in the field? But there's the military commanders, in particular one Ludendorff, about whom more next week, created the myth that they'd just been about to win when they were stabbed in the back by all the Jews and all those leftists at home. Well, it was not the case at all, but what did happen was that just before the armistice on November 4th, 1918, a revolution broke out among German naval units. Actually, it was a mutiny in which the admirals heard about the armistice and were about to send the Navy out to sea for a final Armageddon. I mean, they were looking for Armageddon, and they thought, well, hey, we've been at port since 1916. We haven't fought anybody. Let's go out in a blaze of glory. But they themselves didn't intend to actually be in the blaze of glory. It was the sailors who were going to be. So sailors revolted. They were highly politicized by this time, by unions and by Marxist and union agitators and whatnot. And so they carried out a revolution and set up soldiers and sailors councils November 4th, November 5th, November 6th. Armistice comes on November 11, but the German Revolution is already in progress. It spreads to cities, it spreads to all the major cities, spreads to all the major military units wherever they are. And so this is what we call the November Revolution, the November 1918 German Revolution. Okay? Well, hey, I forgot to put pictures on these. I'll have to put some on there. So here's the point at which Mises, and blank slate here is not too good. Here's the point at which Mises may take off and leave us, okay? In this chapter, there's a very, very careful discussion of the role of the social democrats in all this. And he brings it up more than once. Let me say something about the German Social Democratic Party. It was founded in the 1860s. It was a party which was officially a Marxist party. That is to say, they officially wanted the overthrow of the bourgeois system and the institution of a workers' regime, a workers' paradise, communism. However, everything that happened in Germany, in spite of the Depression, in spite of the interventionism, German industry really went forward. The standard of living, there was enough economic freedom in Germany that the standard of living did rise in the 1870s, eventually, 1880s, and especially in the 1890s, so that almost no workers in Germany in the 1890s could look back and say, well, our lot is many times worse than it used to be, because it wasn't. I mean, they just had more to eat, better places to live, more opportunities to do what they wanted to do, and all of that. In other words, the economic system, the market, as hamstrung as it had been, still produced something. So that's the case. These thoughts gave rise to a movement within German social democracy, as it was called, and that was led, we know primarily, there are other names associated, but primarily by a man named Bernstein. It's in the musician Leonard Bernstein, right? Edvard Bernstein, and Bernstein was, in fact, a man who wanted to revise Marx, and so we call this Marxist revisionism. What Bernstein did was to say, well, okay, so things have gotten better. And, it, you know, it's not to say they'll always get better, but the overthrow of the regime and the revolutionary struggle and all that, that's just not going to happen. What we need to do is to think in terms of revising Marx and working through the parliaments to bring about socialism just bit by bit. Now, for those of you who know about the Webbs and H.G. Wells and the Fabian Society in England, at exactly the same moment, you'll see the parallels here. So international socialism was being was bringing up everywhere at the same time this idea of working through the system instead of overthrowing it, because the system's been pretty good to us, and who wants to lose the comforts of the system in order to overthrow the regime? So that's where the social democrats came in. And many of these social democrats were relieved. You know, a lot of these people were really more union people than social democrats, or more union people than Marxists. They really didn't want to overthrow the system. They wanted higher wages, better houses, shorter hours. So revisionism had a lot of support within Germany. And it kind of split the party in the same way that the Russian Social Democratic Party is going to be split very soon thereafter. So the Social Democrats split, and this major group, the bigger group, the revisionist group, really adopted those policies of social imperialism that 15 and 20 years before had been made by the conservatives. They thought, well, you know, as long as we're going to work through the parliament, let's work for our country. Let's be strong in support of you know, our kind of warfare, welfare state. And so that is the position that Mises talks about. That's the position that the Social Democrats, that's very important to know about, that they were important for this kind of warfare, welfare state. And that we know by the fact that once the Germans, and in Mises' view, the Germans started World War I pretty well. I think you can share the blame around a lot, but that's beside the point right here. Once the war started and the parliament had to pass the war credits bill, then all of these socialists, with just a couple of exceptions, kept party discipline and voted for the war credits. So they were fighting in what they had called an imperialist war, and they voted to finance it anyway. Meanwhile, with the German Revolution having started, if we skip over the war then again and go back, you know, go to the other side, then what happens is that these socialists are handed the reins of government at the end of the war. When the revolution happens, the government that's in power just simply hands over the reins of government, and the Weimar Republic is established. And I won't go through these points. We're kind of moving, and we'll cover this material again. But you have this this particular slide. That's a good reference, a reference point. The Weimar Constitution was the same summer as the Versailles Treaty, and people had those things in mind pretty much constantly throughout the period of the Weimar Republic. There's a lot of dislocation, especially in this first phase. In the second phase of the Weimar Republic, there's much more stable atmosphere, although frankly, this is the time of the ultimate roaring 20s in Germany. It's the time of the decadent Weimar Republic. There's Josephine Baker down there on the left, the American dancer who was so popular in Berlin and Paris in this period. Marlene Dietrich, a real Weimar person, the painting by Otto Dix. It's a time of avant-garde art and music, partly through all this dislocation and hyperinflation and all these other things. But in terms of the government, it cooperated more with the allies in a policy of fulfillment. And so really, by the time we get to 1929, the Germans are working, or they're pretty well back from the war in many ways. They still owe reparations, but even that's been lessened to some extent. So the Weimar Republic lasts until then, and officially, the dates for the Weimar Republic are 1919 to 1933. There is a little hitch at the end, which I'll tell you about. Okay, well, I'll end with just a few minutes of Russian history. I promised this earlier, and we have to fit this in somewhere, and even though this doesn't fit into our omnipotent government overview, I do want to get this in so it next week makes more sense. essentially, I'd like to tell you about, in just a few minutes, Alexander I, the Tsar reformer. If you don't know about, I'm sorry, Alexander II. If you don't know about Alexander II, then it's really hard to figure out where all these revolutionaries in Russia came from. Alexander II came to power in 1855, right on the heels or at the very end of the Crimean War, in which the Russians were getting soundly beaten after a long and costly war. The country had, in effect, a social disaster as a result of this lost war, as sometimes happens with Russia in long wars carried out on the periphery. This monarch, Alexander II, part of the Romanov family, of course, came to power and set his sights on a fundamental reform of Russia. Russia still had serfs. About 45% of the whole population was enserfed. It was just a shocking thing in the 19th century for that to be the case. And in 1861, he freed the serfs. In the course of the 1860s and 70s, he carried out municipal and county reforms. He carried out judicial reforms. He carried out legal reforms having to do with marriage and property and all kinds of things, mostly in a direction we would think of as liberal reforms. And then the Constitution, well, he almost got there, but not quite. He was actually about to sign it on the day that he was assassinated in 1881. So this is a very crucial person in Russian history. Where many Russians talked a good battle in terms of reform, they were almost always state-enhancing reforms. And I got to say, maybe Alexander II's were too, but at least they move in a direction of more openness than the explicitly state-enhancing and authority-enhancing reforms of a person like Catherine the Great or somebody. Well, these reforms set up an atmosphere that I'm just calling the crazy 60s and the deadly 70s. And this atmosphere led to, well, I mean, it's almost like the Protestant Reformation, when suddenly all the peasants rose up and said, well, if there's not authority in the church, then let's just rise up and kill the nobles. This is a time when, because of the atmosphere of reform, everybody got out into the streets and started carrying out protests and speeches and rallies and riots. There's secret movements, there's open movements, there's political movements, there's agitation for a constitution, there's agitation against the constitution. It's a very confusing time, strangely like the 60s in the United States. And the Russian Marxist Party is founded in the midst of all this by Georgi Plekhanov. And so there was, from this point, a Russian Socialist Party. It's not a party that participates in a parliament, because they don't have a parliament. They don't have a constitution, but there are these parties. As time went on, into the 70s especially, the movement, this atmosphere of dislocation led to a movement that was more violent. The organization Land and Freedom advocated going out to the land and sort of learning from the peasants, but it also advocated carrying out violence if need be. And its successor, the People's Will, was even more so. It imbibed much more of the anarchist view and that syndicalist view, that kind of Sorelian view that I talked about two lectures ago. And so a series of assassinations began, again, on this anarcho-syndicalist theory that if you kill enough of the leaders, that the system will fall. And so governors of provinces were assassinated, and leading officials, prime ministers were assassinated, and ministers of all kinds of things. And eventually, the Tsar himself, Alexander II, was assassinated by one such person. So there's a dislocated background here. Especially with, even in Alexander II times, but especially in his son's regime, Alexander III, the repression then really begins to flow. In other words, there's all this activity in the street, and the government then responds by repression. And under Alexander III, the Tsarist secret police, the Okhrana, becomes a very, very large functioning organization that begins to set up huge big prison camps and work camps for the revolutionaries in Siberia. It doesn't begin that, but it expands it rapidly. And so this becomes part of the whole scene. Well, meanwhile, back in Simbirsk, if you take my meaning, anybody know my meaning from that at this point? You may not be there. You may just have left your computer on and gone off. I don't know. But back in Simbirsk, well, that's where Lenin was born. We do have to take up the case of Lenin. He's born in Simbirsk in the east on the western side of the Urals. Actually, his brother got involved in these fracases. He got involved in a group that wanted to assassinate Alexander III in the 1880s, and was hanged for it. So Lenin had a family attachment to the revolutionary movement, and very early on got in the Marxist Party, the one that had been founded by Plekhanov, and he becomes the leading theorist of the party. He takes up Marx's theory of that theory that lays behind all the rest of it, that whatever you do, you go the extra mile, you do whatever has to be done for power, violence included. The revolutionary vanguard has to be formed because the workers are just not going to rise up without it. This whole movement in Russia is, of course, part of the Socialist International, and this movement is fraught with all the same things that the other movements are, like Fabianism and revisionism. And Lenin carries out a preemptive strike against this when he divides the party in 1903, and carries off a minority of the party with him. About the same percentage in other places that remain, you know, hardcore Marxist revolutionaries. And his guys he called Bolsheviks. It's a propaganda move to, because it means the majority party. Then the other guys, the majority he calls minority folks, the Mensheviks. But from that point on, then he tries to build a party that, as he says, calls on its members, the Bolshevik Party, that calls on its members to give not just a little bit of themselves or to be part-time committed, but to give the whole of their lives. So that's the a little bit of the background here. We got to talk much more about this guy Lenin because he's so important to us in the creation of totalitarianism. But the last thing here is just this: that just as a deep background, Nicholas II comes to power in 1894, and he's the Nicholas of Nicholas and Alexandra fame. The Franco-Russian reigns, of course, until the Bolshevik Revolution. The Franco, or until the first Russian Revolution in 1917. He makes an alliance with France in 1893 that has all kinds of world political influence. He gets in a war with Japan in 1904 and loses it. That puts him further in the hole. A revolution in 1905 puts him farther back. And so he's just looking for something to make Russia succeed. He's got so many problems in his background. He's got this huge empire that seems to be falling apart. He's got to do something and got to do it right. And that little story with the royal family we'll talk about later. So, I had a lot to present today, and I hope I didn't go too fast. And if I did, we will remedy that right now in the question and answer period. So let's just transition over to that, and let's see if I can find a good slide. Yeah, let's just go back to that slide just as a good graphic to be on while we do our talk. So let me see if I can get the. You can go on to questions or the question and answer or the chat. And right now I'm watching both, I think. And yeah, I got both on. So let's begin if you have some questions. And if you don't, I will certainly think of questions that you might have. Well, maybe everybody left. I know there will be questions among you. Thank you. Thank you. Jeff says, the centralization drive was worldwide. Why? Well, that's a good question. And you're thinking, okay, I see. It's coming in parts. So Jeff says, the centralization drive was worldwide. Why was that? We had Lincoln and Bismarck at the same time. Well, that's absolutely true, and it's partly these were all related. I mean, you know, Lincoln had his own German scholar to justify things, and a man named Francis Lieber who carried out the same kind of function as many of these theorists and scholars and socialists of the chair did in Germany. I mean, it's a function of the growing state. It's a function of the crisis that nationalism brought on. So if you think about Higgs's prescription of crisis and the growth of the state, then you get these wars that happen, and they're each producing the crisis. And so think of all the wars that, there's not a general war in Europe from 1815 to 1914, meaning most of the powers being involved. But think of this, there is, from the European standpoint, there's the 1848 revolutions, which brought about pretty substantial wars in Italy, Hungary, Austria, Germany, Denmark, And by, there wasn't a revolution in Russia, but it kind of flowed over into Poland a few years later. Not in England, France, that I mentioned, France, there's really civil war in a sense in France in 1848, especially in the street fighting in Paris. So there's a lot of bloodshed and a lot of warfare and a lot of crisis above all. So that brings up these things. And you can talk about the same thing in American history. I mean, there's a nationalist war that goes on with Mexico. Then, of course, the huge civil war. And so all of these wars are state enhancing. And we also have that policy coming in. You have that policy background, the philosophy behind it. It's exactly the same time that Comte is saying, okay, you have to take over your country and rule it from above. And same time Marx is saying that, and same time that the nationalist leaders are kind of imbibing that. So, yeah, it's a great question. And the exact mode of how this happened, then that's the subject of somebody's, it's got to be the subject of somebody's book. It really happens bit by bit. I'll tell you what, there is a good account of this, and if I can think of the name of it right off the top of my head, it's called The Age of Materialism. The Age of Materialism. Shall I type it on my, I wonder if I can do this, can I chat? It's The Age of Materialism, and it's the author is Carlton, Carlton, J-H Hayes, Hayes. And I got to tell you, this great historian of American, an American historian of Europe, is one of the wonderful historians of the 20th century, and he wrote a book that is so complex and elegant that even though it's just a dusty old history book in the William L. Langer series of books on European history, it's a great book. If you can get your hands on it and you want to know, Jeff, this would be especially for you. There's a chapter in there about the national liberals and the extent to which Europe switched to a worshiping of power. Hayes has a great instance in there. He talks about how, the Crimean War ended through the Treaty of Paris. And the Treaty of Paris made there are all kinds of provisions, and the Russians agreed not to do this and that. I won't go into the details. But Hayes chronicles how in 1864 that the Russian diplomats came to the British Foreign Secretary and said, these provisions that we agreed to 8 years ago in the Treaty of Paris, those provisions, and he says, yeah, and they said, well, we're not going to observe those anymore. And the foreign minister says, well, why are you not? And they say, well, the principle of observing treaties is good, but we just observed that the way things are going, that power means more. Power is more important, and so we're just not going to observe them. And the British foreign minister had to say, well, I guess you're right. Power does count more these days. And so there's a whole section of the book, two or three chapters on this process. It's a wonderful book. Carlton J.H. Hayes, it's called A Generation of Materialism. A Generation of Materialism. So, Jeff, if you want to go farther than that, I like that question very well. And Hayes gives us a good take on this, I think. Okay. Let's see. And Charles Haynes wants to talk about Hannah Arendt. Well, I'm not ready to talk about Arendt yet. Let's see. Anti-Semitism in the question period. UNK, we were talking about it. I mentioned Hannah Arendt a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure what your question is, Charles, but I'm saving Arendt for later. We can certainly talk about anti-Semitism, though. Mises' take on nationalism is a very interesting one. And to tell you the truth, it prefigures a lot of later theorizing that went on after World War II, especially in the 1960s and 1970s, about the nature of nationalism. One thing that he makes clear is that there are always, almost always, economic aspects to all this. And his take on anti-Semitism is, of course, that there is above all this kind of economic basis for it. If you take it all the way back into Europe, I mean, if you take those crusading bands in Germany who went along the Rhine and went from city to city massacring Jews in their ghettos, then you also see that people were gaining from that, that they were getting money from that to finance their further livelihood and depredations too. In this process of ethnic cleansing worldwide, of ethnic violence, of killing your neighbors and all that, there's almost always a way to look at this and find the and easily see the financial winners in this. I mean, I give my students all kinds of examples of this. So, for example, if there's you just watch it. Anytime there is instability and riots in Indonesia, then there's going to be people slaughtered, and it's almost inexplicable. You see it in the news. You know, all these Chinese mom and pop store owners were all slaughtered in the hinterland. Well, that's because that there's a huge merchant class, has been for hundreds of years, of Chinese families that go and do business as mom and pop store owners in the hinterlands in Indonesia and throughout the island areas of that part of the world. And they hold people's debts, you know. And so if the mom and pop store, if you owe the mom and pop store some money, why not just kill them? And not only are your debts like that, but you can also loot those stores. That to some extent is the key to much ethnic strife. That goes all the way to the Rodney King riots. You remember who suffered the most in that? What single group suffered the most? Korean families that owned mom and pop stores. So, I mean, they became the targets, and they had nothing to do with the beating of Rodney King. But this is the case. So there's an almost kind of sociological or a demographic element to this kind of killing. And Mises takes this and squarely puts it, says, okay, well, here you go. You have this kind of financial causation here. And, of course, he discusses the other elements of anti-Semitism, too, cultural and religious, although, frankly, except for the recent refugees from Russia, then there's not very much cultural difference in the German Jews and the Germans themselves. I think that their goal had been pretty much becoming a part of society, blending in, and just becoming good members of society. And certainly throughout all this period, Jews were people who made, I mean, the Germany we've been talking about, it's the Jews are helping make that work. Bismarck often said he could not have unified Germany, he could not have fought those wars without the help of his friend and Jewish banker, Gerson von Bleichleder. One of the most enthusiastic scientists helping in World War I to win the war was the inventor of poison gas, Fritz Haber, who was later a Nobel Prize winner for fixing nitrogen, which also helped Germany. Win the war. Not he wanted to help Germany win the war. Germany did not win, but he considered himself a German patriot, as did so many others. To some extent, Mises in Austria was part of a family that were quite patriotic and quite attuned in many cultural ways. But it is certainly true that with the new tendencies to see things in a biological light, a racial light. I mean, the whole business of the whole redefinition of races takes place within social Darwinism. People are using, if you look back through old books and old magazines, you see that people use the term race in a different sense before the 1880s. And the 1880s is kind of this dividing line where we suddenly start talking about these specific type races, what we would have called those categories, maybe something a little different before. So the Jews get caught up in that. And then finally, there's this enormous pressure in the wake of Alexander II and these events in Russia to drive Jews from the Pale of Settlement, where they had been driven before, but they were still within Russia. But with all the pressure in the 90s, then under the reign of Alexander III and of Nicholas II, then Jews just went someplace else, and they were immigrants, and they were disliked for being immigrants, and they didn't just come to New York City and Chicago. They also came to Berlin and Vienna and Breslau, and it's there that this anti-Semitism got the rank and file people who were opposed. So, yeah, that's an important point. Let's see. Let me just follow this up a little bit here and get to the. I need to get some more room on my screen. Okay, yeah, good. Let's see. So the point is that anti-Semitism is not really racial or religious. No, I don't think that's the real point. I mean, just because I say that Mises emphasizes the economic aspect, I don't think that he disregards those other elements at all. There certainly are religious and racial differences, but there are a lot of religious differences among Europeans, so that can't explain everything. As I say, the racial element, that's in a state of redefining. And in fact, it's very, very difficult to, when you get right down to it, try to define a race or figure out who's part of what race. Well, then you come to terms with the with the problematic nature of this word race. And if we say that now, with having DNA evidence and all kinds of more or less objective information on how one would construct a definition of race, then how much more difficult was it back then when there was very little information? So there's a lot of guesswork involved, and so people just thought in a direction that they were already moving, and they sort of thought their way into saying, well, there are these races, and by the way, the Jews are a race. But I'll say this. If we scroll forward to the 1930s, so Hitler's in power as of 1933. Himmler's in charge of the whole big SS empire, which includes the Gestapo and dozens of other offices and departments. And one department, the one that becomes the Reich Chief Office for Security, the RSHA, this office has within its charge the mission of defining what a Jew is. Well, it takes them a year to do it. I mean, they devote full resources. They're trying to figure out, well, if we're going to determine to do something with the Jews, they had already started excluding them from public life and making it illegal to have a civil service job and all those things, the beginnings of what would come, but not all of it yet, and they wanted to define it first, and it took them nearly a year to do it. And so if they were working full time on this and had a staff of people who had all kinds of ideological motivation to define it and still couldn't define it, then this shows you some of the complexities of that. Who is a Jew I mean, for one thing, people are religious at one time in their life and not religious in another. People have family members who are one thing and then another. I mean, there are all kinds of complexities to this. So, yeah, the religious aspect is certainly historically important, but in terms of individuals, it's really hard to say. So I think Mises does a good job talking about a lot of these different aspects. But one thing that's often left out, and one thing that I think has enriched my teaching about the Holocaust for all these years, is this are these passages in Omnipotent Government that really say, okay, yeah. You can shake your head and say, wow, how can people come to these ideas about religion? Or how can they come to these ideas about race? But you don't have to shake your head when you say, okay, why did people go out why did Polish villages kill all their Jewish neighbors even before the Nazis got there? They knew the Germans were coming. They knew that they were going that the Germans were in some way or form going to haul the Jews away. Why did they kill them first and then snatch their houses? I mean, so this is the, you know, this is the, and I could say that, I say it for the Polish villages. There's a famous book about one such case. Happens in all these other countries too. So, these are good questions. And they're questions that Mises can help us answer, I think, better than we could otherwise. let's see. I don't have a question, but were a nation being semi-landlocked, the Germans were hell-bent on expansion. This is from Cam. It's like they have to quickly gobble up land not owned by the major powers in order to compete culturally and militarily, kind of like America did in 1898. Okay, I agree with that totally. It's a good analysis. I think that very similar pressures were on these countries, and there were some substantial differences. And we wait about a decade or decade and a half longer to do it. Although if you put Hawaii in there, and if you put all the fiddling around with the Russians over in the early stages of the Alaska stuff, then in the early stages of the Hawaii stuff, then you're going to get an earlier date. I mean, traditionally we say 1898. Of course, we jump into it with both feet in 1898, and that's about a decade or so after the Germans. So it's a fascinating period. We're doing all the same things. I don't know. Maybe some of you've seen this. Piece I wrote about in the Independent Review a few years ago about the kind of history of concentration camps, a little piece of an article on the history of concentration camps. I'll talk somewhat more about that topic as we go. But it's these imperial powers like Germany in fighting the Hereros in German Southwest Africa, killing the Hereros in German Southwest Africa. It's like the Americans killing the Filipinos in the Moros, especially in the Philippines. And these powers, the British killing Boers, creating concentration camps in South Africa. All of these countries are building the totalitarian stuff. In other words, how can you have totalitarian regimes without concentration camps? And that's what these imperial powers are all building. So yeah, it's a very similar kind of thing. To some extent, they cooperated too. Leslie asks, what factors caused the antagonism that arose between England and Germany in the last part of the 19th century? Well, that's a really good question. While Bismarck was in power, there's a kind of mutual respect, good relations, and all of that. Bismarck leaves in 1890, and Wilhelm II is the king. The Foreign Office the Foreign Office is taken over by folks who really hated Bismarck before and want to show that his policies were wrong. And so they began to just... where Bismarck kept Russia and England very, very friendly, his successors just didn't think that was important. So they insulted the Russians in 1890, and dumped the Russians. They were supposed to renew a treaty called the Reinsurance Treaty, and they didn't do that. So the Russians suddenly became friends of the French. And then in the same decade, since the Russians became friends of the French, then the Germans said, "Oh, it's a dangerous world, and we got to figure out a way to beat those two powers at once." So they built this big Schlieffen plan that was so aggressive. And then at the same time, they began to think about this navy, and the navy seemed like a solution to all these different problems, social problems, and power problems. And as somebody said, yeah, they're just all looking for a way to go forward. So they create this big navy in 1897. And it was so, I mean, the planning for this navy was so incredible. They said, well, there's going to be a risk here, because once we build it, the British might just attack us because, well, frankly, we're kind of building it to fight them someday. And I mean, these are internal correspondence kinds of things. And they say, yeah, well, that's a risk. And so within the German naval planning areas, there actually got to be a theory that was called the Risiko Theorie, the risk theory. So you're going to build this navy. We can't build it all at once. I mean, who builds a whole navy all at once in modern times? It's like saying, well, let's build a dozen cities all at once. And so they were trying to build this huge big battle fleet, and what they did was to try to arrange things in such a way that they'd be low-key and secret up until the time that the British realized that the Germans were building a battle fleet, and thereafter they'd have a few of them ready so that they could counter at least the British home fleet before the others could get back. And in this period, there's just this little period there where they weren't sure that they could handle that defense, and that's called the risk period, and hence the risk theory. It's just insane. I mean, it's just it's what this kind of non-realistic. Can you see that all these things look? I mean, I'm sure you're sitting there scribbling down your papers, neocons. You know, it's exactly the same kind of policy where you sort of give up the rational, pragmatic way of looking at things, and just think about power, which is all the neocons think about, and it's all these guys thought about too. So although sometimes I reject some of these lessons from history, these are certainly similar cases. I mean, these are cases that we know very well from our own day, this kind of reasoning. And so they're sitting there calmly saying, well, you know, here's this friendly country, but when we build our big battle fleet, they're probably going to attack us. And so, you know, it's just crazy. The risk theory, who would have thunk it? So anyway, Leslie, that's the main thing. The Germans just put the British on the other side. And by getting these, you know, then they get these, as they build up these in other imperial places, there are some clashes between the Germans and the British, and, you know, on the borders of Kenya and Tanganyika, and you know, and they had other imperial borders with the British. So there are these other clashes, and you know, the British had always been the client to Turkey, and the Germans were able to offer more to the Turks and put themselves in a role. I mean, the Germans had it easy sometimes because the British Empire was so huge that they generally could go to somebody like the Turks and make the argument, why do you want them to be your backer? Because they're just trying to take you over. And we won't try to do that. We'll just build your railroads and loan you money and be your friend, organize your army and all those things. So the Germans also got on the sides of the Turk. That made the British angry too. So in a way, there's multiple ways to look at this, but it's a fairly simple process of just kind of irrational thinking. I mean, you know, it's just this mode of thought that people adopted, as in our own day. Very good question. Leslie, I hope that is some contribution to answering that. Okay, Jeff says, let me check the, also the question and answer line and see if somebody's, nope, nobody's on that. Jeff says, is your thesis about the importance of canon in the development of the state widely held, or do other historians give less weight to the importance of that new technology? It's held by, yeah, that's a good question. I'd say not that many historians think about it, but certainly it's a part of William McNeill's book on called the Force and History, and it's if you read Krefeld's book CREVELDT about the origins of the state, it's in there. So yeah, I'm not totally alone in that, but I don't think many people emphasize that very much. I mean, think of it, not that many historians or anybody else can really imagine a time without a state, when you just have a kingdom that's operating on a completely different basis, where life is a negotiated kind of thing, and that you go through life in this series of kind of mediated, negotiated situations. It's kind of like, I'm not trying to make, pre-modern Europe out as a sort of paradise lost, but it certainly is a time when you didn't have the state breathing down your neck because there wasn't any state. But yeah, I'd say that, Jeff. Not many, but it's known. It's a kind of a known thing. Let's see. And Laura says, seems like the build-up to atheism is a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Does Mises provide any ideas to combat the pernicious cycle that the build-up entails? Well, there's a good question. Well, yeah, I mean, okay, in this book, I'm not sure, that it's the best place for suggestions, because this is one thing that I probably should have emphasized more earlier, but I thought of this the other day as I was contemplating all this, and that is that this thing was written during wartime. I think the first draft is written in 1938, but the war is about to happen. He's already been run out of his country. Nazis have taken it. I mean, it's all written against this tumultuous background of the Nazi takeover. Purges in Russia are still in progress. Those you can read about those in any newspaper any day. Mises certainly knew about all those. And so totalitarianism was all around him. And he finishes up the book then in the United States after having gotten out of Europe entirely. The war is on. It's not all that clear, I mean, what's going to happen with the war or anything else. And so by 1944, when it's actually published, it looks like the whatever Churchill said, the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end or the medium part of the tail end or whatever. But Mises is speaking in the wartime, from in the midst of that situation. And so, I mean, he can hardly say, well, the solution to all this is just do away with the state, because in that situation, it's not even helpful. There's this discussion about whether, did we go through this already? I guess we did. A discussion about Mises' comments on the state, and if we haven't gotten to it, we will already. I'd have to look at the schedule, but there are times here when he looks at democracy. We did talk about this when he says, well, the state is this necessary thing, and and all that. But on the other hand, it's clear that he's a near, sort of near the anarchist end of things. He wants sovereignty to be pushed down all the way to the, so that every village is sovereign and all of that. So in a way, this is a solution. I mean, just not to have the state, but the interim solution for him is that that people control their governments, that they just simply work for economic freedom and so forth and so on. It has been done in history that people work for these things and it comes out. I mean, the Corn Law League and Richard Cobden, you know, one of my great heroes from the 19th century, this guy worked for 30 years. I mean, that was, he made enough money off his business, he could finance his political activities, and he just worked to do away with the grain tariff in England, and finally did it. And so we tend to think of Cobden as having, you know, led this charge and having carried out the highly beneficial change. So I think that's what Mises would have been thinking about, that people understand the background to this, that they understand the process, and that they understand not only that totalitarians are bad, but that also this is just a part of a, this is just a part of a continuum, that that you have interventionism, that you have a free society here, interventionism here, totalitarianism here. It's not so, it's not so big a difference. We'll talk about later on the political sort of spectrum, and of course, I'm sure you all have ideas about that. But clearly, that's the thing that that thinking of the spectrum as sort of no government or limited government, and then interventionary government, étatism, and then totalitarianism. That's a pretty effective way to just a rule of thumb to think about all these things. Yeah. So, Laura, I hope that is some kind of contribution to that complex question. and certainly, Mises provides some other answers. I mean, here's the key. If you could just stop the manipulation of the means of exchange, then I mean that too, just that one thing. And I think that's the, you know, that's the crucial part of this you know, the potential now for ending the Fed or investigating the Fed. I mean, I think that's the, that's a crucial, crucially important thing. That if you cut off the ability to manipulate this, this money, because any small minute, once you've got the power that that any of the great central banks or the Federal Reserve, any of them do, to manipulate these things, to manipulate a loan over here and take these trillions off the top there and put them toward this project over here, then these are crucially important things in modern history that almost you know, almost no historians have paid real attention to. So you can stop that, and Mises does suggest that. Okay, are you out of questions? Have I? Let's see. Have I missed any? Let me see. No Q&A questions, and. Oh, there are more. I had to roll down. Okay. Matthew asks this. A view for the rise of nationalism that I have encountered, but that Mises doesn't discuss, is that after the Enlightenment, an increasing number of people started to lose faith in religion. So essentially, the love of nation was replaced with the love of God. Do you think this view has any truth to it? Oh, I think it's absolutely a part of it. And Mises doesn't emphasize that as very much, does he? But I think certainly it's a surrogate religion. You know, I mentioned the Italian nationalist theorist Mazzini last time. And, you know, his Mazzini's writings on this in the 1830s, 1840s, they're very much along these lines. I mean, they're saying, you know, if you want to get involved in some, in some heartfelt, deep, profound thing, get involved in your nation. That's why all of the hyper-nationalist movements, and among those I would certainly include Italian fascism and German Nazism, that's why all of those, I mean, and I'm sure you're, since you asked the question, Matthew, I'm sure you're, that's what you're thinking of too. I mean, all of these have quasi-religious ceremonies involved with them, and moonlight ceremonies or torchlight parades or kind of primeval things, it's ceremonies at night that are involved. I mean, and sometimes they make religions to go along with them too. But yeah, I think these are surrogate religions. And I think this goes right along with what Kolff was saying. People can't get along without it. And so when people began to lose faith in great numbers, and it's not even just the Enlightenment. That's the start of it. But then what happens is, of course, all this urbanization that goes along with the Industrial Revolution, that contributes too. And so, yeah, I mean, here's a friend of mine who is an Alan Bloom student, and my friend's in the political science department here at Austin College. He's kind of a Strauss student too. But what these guys talk about, and they talk about it positively, Bloom and Strauss, these sort of neo-conservative, you know, giants of political philosophy, what they speak of in very moving terms is that in modern times, people have lost any kind of sense of the sublime in their lives. Since they've lost their religious convictions, they've lost this sense of something beyond themselves, some greater cause, some cause that's sublime. And therefore, the state, in these guys' view, needs to think about supplying that. Okay, that's an oversimplification of what they say. But it is the stated reason why Strauss, for example, would talk about, you know, that here's something the fascists had that we didn't. They have this sense of the sublime, and so how do you solve this problem of having a modern state without a sense of the sublime? And I'm afraid that we've kind of solved that. But yeah, I think there's a lot to that, where you elevate the nation to the sublime. I mean, this is what they look at the syllabus. The first quotation I put on there, I think I intended to, was this whole business: nothing before the state, nothing above the state. It's supposed to be, you know, from the French Revolution on, it's supposed to be your father and your mother. So, yeah, I think that's a very, very important aspect of all this. And all of the hyper-nationalists latched onto that. Well, eventually even Stalin had to latch on to some kind of nationalism during World War II and the whole rhetoric of the Patriotic War and all that, but not nearly so much as these, as Hitler and Mussolini. Let me see if I've got more questions here. We've still got 11 participants, or at least, we have 9 attendees still. Okay. So, any more questions? I suppose we're about out of time. I mean, we're coming to the close. I sort of announced that these things would last an hour and 50 minutes, I think, or something like that, and I've been a little going over each time. It's not your fault, but mine, since I go a little long in the first half. But are there any more questions? I'd be glad to respond or not. Well, anyway, if you've written an essay for the first time around, and what's now due is just about this material we just read, and it's the thing called quiz. It's not actually a quiz. I mean, I suppose it is. I give you a grade on it, but it's a little essay about the question involved there. I've written another question for next week. So if you're going to be involved in the grade, you know, the grade getting option here, then be sure and do that. And I will see it on Moodle and send you some comments back and all that. So, well, thank you, Matthew, for saying that. And thanks for being in the course. And thank you to everybody. And so I guess we will call it quits for today. Bye-bye. See you next week. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you, Laura. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. See you later.